This time of year, a good hoodie is absolutely essential. But these days, it's tough to find one that will last through the season. That's why the American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. Slate Magazine called it the greatest hoodie ever made, and from cotton to zipper, it's made right here in the USA. It's crafted with timeless style, heavyweight fleece, a double-lined hood, and reinforced elbow patches, which means this hoodie can withstand any outing or adventure. It'll be your new favorite hoodie, and you can depend on it for years to come. Plus, buying from American Giant means supporting local communities of farmers, manufacturers, and more. This season, snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code CLASSIC24 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code CLASSIC24.
Miles here is an electrician running wiring for this new home build.
Good morning.
Miles doesn't have time for funny business.
I guess.
Miles traded up to Sirius Commercial Auto Insurance from GEICO for customized coverage that grows with his business, all for seriously low rates.
So, where's the GEICO surprise cameo?
Come again?
You know, like some big famous football player or something. He's gonna bust through that wall, isn't he?
No, this ad is serious business.
Guys, get over here! You gotta see this!
No, there's nothing funny over here. Sorry. Get more with GEICO Commercial Insurance. Trade up today at geico.com/commercial.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to the UFC 310 post-show. I am John Pollock, joined by Boston's own Eric Marcotte, who is joining us bright and early. From the 705, if I'm not mistaken.
You absolutely nailed it.
You know, and when we're discussing these pay-per-views, I remember Eric right at the beginning of the year, he said, hey, 310, I want to be there for 310. I want to be there for the last pay-per-view of 2024 as we say goodbye to an extremely profitable year for the UFC. I think they're going to make it. I think they're going to be okay. A real landmark year for the company when it came to profits and generating further income. How are you today, Eric?
I'm doing pretty well. Yourself?
I'm good. I'm always I always feel like I'm talking to you, and you may be about to flatline on some of these shows. I mean, you are the man that sacrifices the most for the post wrestling community.
Listen, I'm always ready to talk about some MMA, okay? And you know what? Unlike UFC 309, which I did not give a fuck about, this card, I was actually excited for this one. How about you?
I was actually very much looking forward to this card. Like, I saw a lot of people that were just kind of, you know, yeah, this was not like your giant marquee card, but I thought from top to bottom, like, this was one of those shows I think you can get a sense, like, the day of, I was really looking forward to this card. There were a lot of interesting stories, and it was not just confined to the main card. There was a lot of interesting stuff throughout the whole show. I even saw like some interest in like heavyweight fights, which I know, Eric, is your just your absolute antidote that you would prefer not to ever discuss. But we will have a 3-round heavyweight fight, and I'm most curious your thoughts on two heavyweights going 15 minutes.
I guess that was one of the talks of the card, but to echo your own thoughts, yeah, top to bottom, I was really into this card. I mean, you had a lot of high-level matchups on paper between very talented fighters throughout, and they even sprinkled in some big names of the past, we'll say, throughout the prelims for some of the more casual viewers.
And, of course, a whole new generation of fight fans being exposed to the Gracies in 2024. A huge representation of the Gracies we will get to later. And maybe one of the most apolitical UFC pay-per-views of the year. I mean, it was largely just confined to the late nominee for Trainer of the Year, that being the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, who might have gotten the most shout-outs and punctuated by... There is only one man who can make America great again, and that is my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
Oh, yeah. Jesus went over on this card, brother. You may be right. He might have been thanked more times than he has ever been thanked before in a single card here.
This felt like old school UFC politics. It's like we got a fight among two flat earthers. You know, it's, and a very clear, resistance to, make America grapple again throughout that match from one Crone Gracie. So I found this to be fine. Like, it wasn't until the post-fight press conference when Bryce Mitchell got to share his views on vaccines and such. So, I mean,
this is perfect, really.
This was like, I just felt like I was in a totally different sport. It was one where it was like it was divorced from politics. So, I mean, wonderful.
This is a big card. We got what may have very well been the first fist fight between two flat earthers in like 200 years. That's big.
Yeah, and one of them was flattened by the end of it. We will get into that. Tonight's show, well, we should say Saturday show from the T-Mobile Arena in Las Vegas, announced attendance 18,648. Live gate of, I'll say this for pay-per-views, only $5 million. I mean, this is like on the lower end. I mean, $5 million. But we had John Anik, Joe Rogan, and Daniel Cormier, Eric's favorite commentary duo or trio in all of sports period, coming together for the final pay-per-view of 2024. But taking headline honors after Bilal Muhammad fell out due to injury, his fight with Shavkat Rakhmonov got transformed into Shavkat Rakhmonov taking on Ian Machado Gary. So taking the main event billing, flyweight champion Alexandra Pantoja in his second fight of the year against the UFC debutante Kai Asakura. And Eric, did you get to see any of the promotion, especially during fight week, of Asakura? And I mean, how effective of a job do you think the UFC did in introducing Asakura, who, if you follow Rising, you're obviously very familiar with, but I would imagine a lot of fight fans tonight watching him for the first time.
I don't watch too much of the UFC's pre-event coverage at this point, but I did
notice. You do not strike me as an embedded viewer wondering.
Oh, John, I used to watch so much embedded. I used to be addicted to UFC embedded, okay? I did my time. It's just like the Ultimate Fighter. I watched so much of it. I'm immune to it now. I don't need to. I know everything that happens.
Aren't you curious what they're eating during the week and how they pack?
I know that they stood in airports while ambient car sounds were playing. I know one of them got a haircut. I know everything, all right? But,
the oh-so-subtle product integration where a fighter is just naturally playing a video game or espousing the virtues of this nutritional supplement.
With their Monster energy drink in their hand, wearing their Venom gear, you know, all that good stuff. No, I don't watch too much of the UFC's pre-event promotional stuff at this point, but I did notice that they were uploading like full Ryzen fights onto their YouTube page, which I was trying to go back and think about if there was a time where they would have done this before, and they might have for Manel Kopp, but that's the only example I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, it's very rare you're in this situation where a fighter is debuting in the UFC and in such a high profile fight, much less a pay-per-view main event. I thought overall they did, like, this felt like, really from a bygone era of the UFC where you really felt this promotional push for, Kai Asakura in the lead up to this. And he has a highlight reel that is very fan friendly that you can cater to an audience that this, and I mean, really did live up to that billing. I mean, this was a very exciting fight for the duration of which it, lasted here. But, Alexandra Pantoja, this is a very tall ask, for someone making their UFC debut. We last saw him against the office's own Steve Ersig back at UFC 301 in May. And that followed a title defense against Brandon Royval a year ago. And really leaning on the Japanese nostalgia, we got Lenny Hart for the entrance for Kai Asakura as he came out to the Ryzen music. And Kai Asakura, he had one goal in mind, and that was to get a highlight reel akin to Jorge Masvidal as he comes out with his leaping knee. And Pantoja just rocks him with a left hand. Asakura is going a million miles an hour. It took me about 5 seconds to realize this man is going to crash and burn, but oh, the fireworks are going to be tremendous to watch. I mean, I never had a question in mind of how this was going to end. But Asakura is he's really quick. He is going with kicks to the body, and Pantoja just hits his own knee right up the center, and then it's Pantoja landing his own kicks. you know, for Flash, certainly Asakura looked great in these 5 minutes, but for substance, it was all Pantoja in these opening 5 minutes. And the second round, there was this insane scramble with Pantoja locking onto the back of Asakura and pretty much just pounded him to the ground with a body triangle applied. And Asakura tried to fight this off, but this rear naked choke was so deep. And Asakura went to sleep at 2 minutes and 5 seconds of the second round. For an East Coast viewer, as myself and Eric subscribe to, getting a second round finish this late past 1 a.m. Eastern time, never going to complain about that. And I'll just say this was fun while it lasted, for 7 minutes of high octane flyweight action, and Pantoja really, I think, further establishing his dominance at this weight class.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better. It was entertaining while it lasted, and it went the exact way that you probably would have thought this fight was going to go going into it. I mean, Pantoja just looked leagues above Asakura here. And Asakura is a fun fighter, but I don't think, for those of us who are familiar with his game, there was a reason why he was considered an underdog by a lot of people going into this one. When he's fought some of the big names that you'd be familiar with just by looking through his Wikipedia page, there are some losses here. And Pantoja was a league above those guys, and you saw that play out in this fight. Asakura, like, he's very good, do not get me wrong, and he landed some good knees up the middle in there, but almost everything Pantoja landed was hurting Asakura. All those hard hooks, all those kicks to the body, and he was taking him down at will as well before finally getting the finish. It was a beautiful performance, and it was a fun fight while it lasted, but it was a dominant one for Pantoja.
Yeah, I don't think you could have just completely thrown out Asakura from having that chance to land something of significance. That can always happen. But again, if you watch a lot of his prior fights, I mean, he's very exciting to watch. But part of that is because, you know, he will put his chin out there. He can absorb a lot of damage. The Juan Archuleta fight, where Archuleta did miss weight for, like, Asakura is losing that fight. And it's a pretty strong, Archuleta looked very strong in this fight until it turned around at the end and Asakura was able to finish him. But he's an exciting fighter. I have no doubt that he is going to get probably, you know, a prominent follow-up in this division. And this being flyweight, we could see this fight 3 or 4 more times.
Oh, yeah. At this point, Pantoja has been, like, tasked with beating every single fighter in this division at least 3 times. So I'm sure we'll see this no shortage. Age is Pantoja's only enemy at this point.
So that was our main event for the show, and coming after it, it was the natural call out. Pantoja wants to fight Demetrius Johnson, who is not in the UFC, is has announced he has retired. But why not? I mean, that really tells you where Pantoja's mind is at, where the game is, like, who has he not beaten 2 times that we can now put him in there with? Kai Kara-France being the other name that you heard at the post-fight press conference. But I mean,
another fighter he's already beaten.
Well, he hasn't beaten France twice. I was like, yeah. Well, that's quite the qualifier of who is going to become the challenger. You notice the fact that Asakura walked into the UFC and there was this guy has not fought at flyweight since 2017. There was no one arguing about this because there is no person that he is leapfrogging in this division. Like, you come in and it's like, you don't even have to win a fight and you could end up fighting the champion right away. Like, this is a wide open division with a champion that is at least the only stability in this weight class.
This is as much of a division being cleaned out as division possibly can be cleaned out, because on his way to the title and his title defenses since, Pantoja's really beaten everybody, and he's beaten your top guys multiple times. Like, he's beaten Brandon Moreno 3 times. That's insane. He's beaten Brandon Royval twice. John Anik tried to set it up after the win. He's like, oh, Brandon Royval coming off a big win, could be next in line. And Daniel Cormier just shoots.
He beat him twice.
He's already beat this guy twice. It's
they cut to Royval too. It's like, is this the seed you're planting for us? Like, third time's a charm. Like,
I don't blame him for calling out Demetrius Johnson.
Why not?
It's the biggest fight possible. They're kind of around the same age, and DJ, you shot it down pretty quickly. It's not going to happen, but shoot your shot. I mean, if we're talking about a fight that is a bit out of left field, I guess that would make sense would be Deiveson Figueiredo, but I'm not sure if he's down to make that flyweight cut anymore, but he holds a win over Pantoja, and it's one of the best flyweight fights you'll ever see. So they could run that one back, I guess.
What could have been for Cody Garbrandt and his flyweight run?
Oh my God, I totally forgot that even happened.
Remember that?
Vaguely.
Our other five-round fight of the show, and this is was a really interesting fight for a lot of reasons. You had Shavkat Rakhmonov, ranked third, taking on the seventh-ranked Ian Machado Gary. Both men undefeated, 18-0 for Rakhmonov. Machado Gary, 15-0. And I think Gary received a lot of credit, and justifiably so, for taking this fight. This was Rakhmonov was scheduled to fight Bilal Muhammad on this show, opted to stay on and fight a legitimate contender in Gary, who is stepping in against the guy that has had a lot of trouble securing opponents. And I think we'll talk about where each guy's stock is after this fight, but it did go the full five rounds. And I mean, the first two rounds, you thought like this is, it could come down to one of these rounds where so little happened. And Shavkat in the first round lands a clean right hand at the end. And that was the deciding factor of this first round. It pretty much was that one shot. It was a lot similar in the second. The two are very tentative with one another, but you're seeing Rakhmonov snapping his jab and following that up with a right hand. And there was a partial connection with a spinning back fist, but not the most action-packed first 10 minutes. Then into the third, this is Gary's best round so far, as they are clinching up against the fence. They're worn to work, and then Mark Goddard actually steps in and separates them. And this is when Gary starts using his jab. And despite Rakhmonov landing a big right at the end, it's Gary here that is, you know, pretty much the aggressor with his leg kicks, which were pretty significant in terms of the disparity. Rakhmonov landed two leg kicks the entire five rounds, whereas Gary, it was like 21 leg kicks he used throughout. But the big controversy is at the end of the third round, his shorts are ripped, and we get a mid-fight wardrobe change for Ian Machado Gary, who's going to take his sweet time to change his shorts here. And Cormier and Rogan, they were extremely grateful that he had worn boxers underneath his shorts.
Yes. Unlike Uriah Faber that one time against Dominic Cruz, it's ingrained in my mind. Thank you, Ian Gary.
The fourth round, Rakhmonov hits a spinning kick to the body and then gets his first takedown, entering Gary's guard. And he's landing inside of the guard, loses a darce attempt, and then gets another double leg and lands several shots at the end. A big round for Rakhmonov. So we head into the fifth round, and Gary scrambles, taking Rakhmonov's back, gets a body triangle, and all of a sudden, he is going for a choke on Rakhmonov. And this is the most vulnerable we have ever seen Shavkat Rakhmonov, as this choke is pretty damn deep. And Rakhmonov holds on, and he ends up reversing to change the position, but not delivering a whole lot of damage. Gary gets in some shots at the end, and we go to the judges' scorecards. The first time Rakhmonov has not gone to the first time that he has gone to the judges. Before we read the scores, what was your tally at the end of 25 minutes?
I had it 48-47 for Rakhmonov. I thought this one was pretty straightforward. I mean, as you said, the first two rounds, not too much happens, but the few big moments belong to Rakhmonov. So simple enough. The third round's all Gary with his various kicks to the body and legs. Fourth round, all Rakhmonov, takes him down, gets the ground pound to secure the round, and then into round five, the big moment comes from Gary. So in my opinion, this is as straightforward as scoring can get for a fight.
I had a 50-45 for Gary. No,
right.
I had the identical score as Eric here. 3-5 for Gary and 1-2-4. And those were the identical scores that all three judges had. 48-47, Shavkat Rakhmonov improves to 19-0 and pretty much called out Bilal Muhammad. They did the stare down in the octagon. I mean, if that was not the direction they were going, it clearly is now. What did you think of the performance by Rakhmonov and conversely, Ian Machado Gary going 25 minutes with Rakhmonov? How did you think, first of all, let's just start off with Rakhmonov and getting this title fight coming out of this. I mean, it seemed pretty obvious that, you know, he would not be risking the title fight here unless he had lost this fight.
I think if you came into this fight looking at either of these guys really as just like undefeated, unstoppable monsters, then you'd probably come out of the saying, wow, well, they both looked human here. And that's certainly fair. But I think taking into account the fact that Gary took this fight on such short notice and Rakhmonov is coming off a long layoff and was trained to fight someone with the polar opposite style to Belal Muhammad, I don't think it's too shocking that there was a bit of hesitancy from both fighters early on. They both look good here. Ian Gary in particular, not too many people have been able to, well, no one had gone the distance of Rakhmonov before this. Rakhmonov, to his own credit, I mean, he won the fight pretty decisively. It's a strong win. I don't think this really is going to change the tune of too many people on either of these guys, except for the people who thought, oh, this guy's unstoppable and it's just going to run through everybody, right?
I thought Ian Machado Gary like upped his stock just in taking this fight in, you know, he was preparing for to fight Joaquin Buckley next weekend, but this is like that's a big shift to go from Buckley to Rakhmonov and to go 25 minutes with him. And you know, he had that choke in so deep. Like, I think for Gary, here's a guy that's 25 years old, and I think he, I don't think he's hurt one iota by this. In fact, I think he comes out with a stronger sense among people about his kind of upper limits at this weight class to go 25 with Rakhmonov. And I think it's a compelling fight with Belal Muhammad and Shavkat Rakhmonov. And I think we saw Rakhmonov here against somebody, you know, the significance of Gary, and I'm really interested to see like what the lines are for that Muhammad Rakhmonov fight, which is it's a very interesting fight, and I think you got a lot of insight here into seeing 25 minutes of Rakhmonov.
Yeah, I'm with you, and I think we'll see a very different Shavkat Rakhmonov in that fight as well. A fight where, unlike this one, you have to imagine he'll be focusing more on his striking, where he holds a decisive edge over Muhammad, as opposed to the wrestling where he tried to spent a lot of the fight in the clinch with Gary here.
Over the last 75 years, over 10,000 chemicals have been introduced to our food supply. Yet the EU only allows 300 food additives. But at Thrive Market, we bring our members the highest quality brands and restrict more than 1,000 ingredients found at conventional grocery stores. Making the switch is easy with our Healthy Swaps scanner, which finds better versions of all your favorite pantry, snacking, and home essentials without the added junk, dyes, and fillers. Plus, it's all delivered straight to your door. So if you're looking to shop at a grocery store that actually cares about your health, go to thrivemarket.com/podcast and you'll get 30% off your first order and a free gift.
Miles here is an electrician running wiring for this new home build.
Good morning.
Miles doesn't have time for funny business.
I guess.
Miles traded up to Serious Commercial Auto Insurance from GEICO for customized coverage that grows with his business, all for seriously low rates.
So where's the GEICO surprise cameo?
Come again?
You know, like some big famous football player or something. He's going to bust through that wall, isn't he?
No, this ad is serious business.
Guys, get over here. You got to see this.
No, there's nothing funny over here. Sorry. Get more with GEICO Commercial Insurance. Trade up today at geico.com/commercial.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Now it is time for our heavyweight action on the main card. Can always be a tale of multiple divisions when we see these. A rematch, Eric, of one of your all-time rewatchable fights. Cyril Gane, Alexander Volkov from June 2021. A five-round affair by these two men, which set up Cyril Gane beating Derek Lewis and then would fight Francis Ngannou after that. It started off his path. So a rematch here. Gane, 34 years of age, and of course, had the loss to Francis Ngannou, had the loss to John Jones, but coming off a win over Sergey Spivak, while Volkov has quietly put together four wins in a row. Would that streak continue? Well,
and has loudly changed his hairstyle, coming out with cornrows. My God.
He came out with cornrows. He's also got like a mural on his back on top of that. A very interesting look is one Alexander Volkov, Bellator alumni himself. So early on, it's it's gone, scrambling to his feet in the first minute and does get a takedown. It's gone now, Mr. Wrestling. Goes for a heel hook. might have worked on that wrestling, but man, this heel hook game of his, I think this is one we need to retire, okay?
Got it that one time 5 years ago, okay?
Yeah, there was also a very blatant fence grab here. Gon gets a knee to the body and applies a guillotine at the end. So I thought a Gon round here in the first. Second round, there's a spinning back fist that stuns Gon, and Volkov is attacking him with various kicks, including a high one. Gon then cracks him with a right, and Volkov tries for the guillotine. Gon takes him down into side control. So Volkov's in threat of the Von Flu choke, which I think is Joe Rogan's favorite observation whenever that there is a takedown and someone holds on to the guillotine, but Gon lets him stand. Into the third we go, and I thought after 10 minutes, I was like, this has been a very good heavyweight fight. I had it even after two rounds, and that set the stage for round three. And I don't know if either of these two were really ready for the extra 5 minutes. The one thing with Ciryl Gon, you always have to worry about this man's fight IQ. And this was a curious strategy for your final 5 minutes, where this was a razor-thin fight that you could easily score one apiece. Volkov goes for a jab. He stops a takedown and goes for it's Gon going for a Kimura off of his back. But he can't get this Kimura, and it is so obvious that this is just, this is like if you were out fishing and like the worm had fallen off the hook, and you're just still convinced that you're going to catch a fish without a worm. And that was Gon here. And it's like the time is ticking and they're in this like neutralized position. This Kimura is in no threat to Volkov. Finally, Gon lets go of this thing with 90 seconds left, and Volkov is in half guard and peppers him with like the lightest of strikes, which are the difference maker in this entire fight, handing Volkov this round. This is one of those fights where I like to say, did Alexander Volkov win this fight or did Ciryl Gon lose this fight?
Wrong on both accounts.
We go to the scorecards and I'm thinking like, well, Gon blew it, and then we get the split decision in favor of Ciryl Gon. Now, I was stunned, almost as stunned as Ciryl Gon's corner, who his coach just was like, how did we win this? Gon leaves. He just walks out. I'm convinced Ciryl Gon thought he lost this fight, and he is then directed back into like, no, you won, and he has to go back. You have never seen a man more upset that he won a fight than Ciryl Gon as he speaks to Joe Rogan, explaining that he broke his toes in the first round. He was not happy about this fight. He said that over and over and over again as Joe Rogan tried to like talk this man off a ledge. This fight was going so well, Eric, and it wasn't a fight that I had high hopes for, but then this third round was just a mess, and I mean, it was close enough. You can't get too upset about a decision going the other way, but I did score this for Volkov, and I think many did as well. But that, like this third round, it's just a shame that a fight comes down to, well, really, it didn't come down to this because it was, I believe it was the second round where the judges disagreed. First and third, they agreed on those rounds being split.
Right. I definitely was not looking forward to this fight, given that it's a rematch, Eric, of a fight that didn't happen all too long ago. And it was a very one-sided fight. Ciryl Gon beat Alexander Volkov very easily in their first matchup. So I thought this was a very uninteresting rematch. But then these first 10 minutes play out, and I thought Alexander Volkov looked great. I thought he looked like a much improved fighter. He was taking the fight to Gon while he was just freezing in their prior matchup. I was very impressed by his performance here, especially in that second round. The third round was one of the worst things I've ever seen, but you have to take and leave what you can at heavyweights. I of course scored the fight for Volkov as well. I wasn't too upset by the decision. Like I could see scoring that second round for Ciryl Gon. They both kind of landed one good shot each, and then I think it was just the volume for Volkov that tipped it for me. But definitely a tough break for Volkov, who, I don't know, he even might have been in line for another title shot if he won this one.
We've been robbed of the rubber match between these two with this decision. What like this heavyweight division is just such a, it's in a stalemate. I mean, John Jones is not going to be fighting anytime soon. Like, is Tom Aspinall going to take a fight in the interim? I would say for it's not like this was a performance where anyone is clamoring for Tom Aspinall and Ciryl Gane. And like, what does a Gane even take away from this fight? Which is, I would say, even if he had looked great in this fight, what was going to be next while you have this confusion over the weight class and in a fight where so many didn't even think he won the fight? Like, I think Ciryl Gane is in the exact same place he was going into this fight, coming out of it, and is probably going to be thrown against another top five heavyweight next.
Yeah, I agree. He's the definitive number three at heavyweight right now. And I think there will be a time where we get that Aspinall-Gane matchup, and perhaps it'll be more interesting by that point. Right now, it's hard to see anything other than Aspinall just taking him down and submitting him. But it's heavyweight for you. I mean, shit.
Matt, well, we're going to go a few weight classes lower to Bryce Mitchell and the returning Crone Gracie. I know this is what really, this is what got your $80 for this pay-per-view. It's Crone Gracie, his first fight since May of 2023 when he lost to Charles Jourdain. And prior to that, hadn't fought since 2019. But here he is back in the UFC on a main card, no less, on pay-per-view, taking on the 16-1 Bryce Mitchell, who we have not seen for a year after he was sent into a... land of despair, courtesy of the hands of Josh Emmett, one of the more violent knockouts of last year. And he was not going to be taking on a very violent opponent in Crone Gracie, who after this entire fight landed six significant strikes and this crowd exceptionally restless, because Crone Gracie had one objective, and that was to pull guard at every chance. And that is what he does immediately as Mitchell is on top in half guard, then ends up in his full guard, and Gracie is doing nothing off his back. It is, you know, very, very minor strikes from Bryce Mitchell, but I mean, minor strikes beat no strikes, and Bryce Mitchell takes the first round. The second, Mitchell wants to keep this one standing, but instantly Gracie pulls guard, and this crowd is just fed up with this strategy because he is doing nothing with it. This is not a guy with this active guard. That said, Mitchell would stand up and he starts throwing knees. Gracie pulls guard again. However, Gracie does get active at this point and he does go for an armbar, then moves to a triangle. I wouldn't say Mitchell was ever in that deep trouble, although, I mean, he was, his arm was caught at a certain point, and this was the most effective Crone Gracie was this entire fight. But he loses the arm, and Mitchell ends the round with ground and pound. So even with the submission threat, I thought it was a Mitchell round. And then the third, Bryce Mitchell has now figured out the Gracie guard pull, because now when Crone goes for it, Mitchell just slams him going down and then follows with two violent elbows from hell, putting out Crone Gracie at 39 seconds of the third round. Bryce Mitchell gets your win, improving to 17-1. And he is going home to celebrate Jesus Christ this Christmas, because Christmas does not celebrate Jesus Christ enough. So there is your winner, Bryce Mitchell, which we did get an always entertaining post-fight speech from Bryce Mitchell.
Right. This was
an awful fight until it ended.
An all-time bad performance from Crone Gracie here. And I said the exact same thing after his last fight in the UFC. And I think he looked even worse here. I mean, the few strikes that he attempted on the feet were just not good. His movement looked off. He pulled guard at every opportunity and he didn't do anything with it. He pulled guard and basically got knocked out in the process of doing it, which is one of the most humiliating ways to get finished. This was really bad, but this guy has it figured out. Okay. He loses a fight. He disappears for sometimes years. He comes back and he gets a bigger fight each time. So in 2 years, we're going to see Crone Gracie come back against like Max Holloway or something. All right. This guy has it all figured out. Well, maybe not at all figured out. There's some things he seems a bit lost on, but career political wise, apparently. I don't want to take anything away from Bryce Mitchell, of course. I mean, it was a good finish. He's a good fighter, and this was a fight that I think was beneath him.
I agree. I mean, I think you really could have looked at the The featherweights represented on this card. We're going to get into two more here. But of course, one of the stories throughout the week was your former bantamweight champion in Aljamain Sterling and Movsar Evloev, who is undefeated. You know, it's for the fan, I can understand, like, what do you really care? If you're the fighter, I think it's a sign of where, how prominently you are billed and promoted, to kind of get that slight. And a Kron Gracie here is on your pay-per-view main card. I don't know if we're going to see Kron Gracie in the UFC again. If we do, maybe it'll be when he turns 40.
All we can say for certain is we won't see him for a while. That's how he rolls.
Dana White was given the bait to try and run down Kron Gracie's performance, and he would not take it. Like, he called out the interview, the person in the media scrum or the press conference for, I don't appreciate your leading question, calling his strategy limited. I was like, if Kron Gracie was not limited tonight, I would love an example of what was limited, because this was a man that, like, go do jiu-jitsu tournaments. Like, that's what Kron Gracie should be doing. Like, he's world class. He did not want to engage in any striking. It's like, this is mixed martial arts, and there's a whole aspect, a massive aspect of the game that he just did not want to participate in this. And that made for a very dull fight that did have a big finish at the end.
I mean, something happened with Kron Gracie after that first loss, because if you recall that fight against Cub Swanson, I mean, he was completely down to swing and bang for 15 minutes with Cub, even though he was getting lit up. And since then, it has been, his two fights in the next 5 years, it has been guard pull, ground and pound, guard pull, ground and pound, slam finish.
Well, if you're interested in Bryce Mitchell's thoughts on some of Donald Trump's cabinet picks, that was all covered at the post fight press conference. And buckle up for a Bryce Mitchell.
No, he doesn't believe in buckles, John, please.
Yes. Duho Choi against Nate Landwehr was our other featherweight fight. I mean, didn't take a whole lot to figure out what they wanted out of this fight. And what we got was Duho Choi, who, I mean, this guy had one of the all-time great fights with Cub Swanson right here in Toronto, which was amazingly 8 years ago. And, you know, he did have to do his mandatory military service in South Korea and lost out on 3 years of his career. And the thought was that, you know, that Cub Swanson fight probably did a ton of damage for this guy. But whether it's been the extended time off, he did come back in February of last year and then is coming off the Bill Algeo win in July. He came into this fight, and this might have been the best we've ever seen Duho Choi look. Standing, I mean, this guy was just levels above the striking. Like, the late Nate Landwehr is a very entertaining fighter, but he was taking on a guy that was just on point with his striking. He's rocking him with this left hook early on, getting the jabs through Nate's guard, and then Choi is landing with the left hook, mixing it up to the body. Very strong opening round. The second, it's Choi's leg kicks that are very effective, buckling Landwehr, and hits a spinning, there is a spinning elbow that Landwehr lands, probably his best strike of the whole fight. Choi gets this great takedown, he so easily moved to mount, and he's just taking his back, he flattens Landwehr, and Choi lets him up at the end, and just immediately takes him down again, like just demoralizing type of wrestling. And then in the third, Nate Landwehr is exhausted as he ends up on his back, inside control, and there's a crucifix applied, and Choi is just dominating him with these short elbows. Landwehr can't defend, so the referee stops it at 3:21 of round number three as Duho Choi gets the win, and he wants to fight Bryce Mitchell, who hadn't even fought yet. So that told you Duho Choi's faith in Kron Gracie getting it done in the next fight.
This was an absolutely remarkable performance. Probably the performance of the card, maybe Pantoja aside. He looks so good here, so sharp on the feet, dodging everything Landwehr was throwing back at him. His grappling looked phenomenal. I mean, finishing the fight from the crucifix. This was, yeah, probably his best all-around performance in the UFC. He has some early on where he just sparks guys, but those are like 9 years ago now, right? This was the most he's shown in a long time, and it's the kind of fight that might get him a shot against a ranked opponent like Bryce Mitchell in his next
fight. I think that would be a great fight. I mean, they brought it out, they introduced it here, Choi did, Bryce Mitchell said he was down to fight him. I think it's a great fight for these two. I was stunned. They did give out the bonuses after. Duho Choi did not get a performance of the night bonus, but I thought he was one of the big stories of this whole card. He just looked so seasoned in comparison to, he's always been an exciting fighter, but this was such a dialed in striker that had introduced wrestling as well. This is someone I think, like, perhaps some of the years away might have allowed him to recover some, because this guy was taking on a ton of damage in his first run with the UFC. But a great win here for him to open up the main card. Let us, we will briskly go through the prelims here. We start off with Dominic Reyes and Anthony Smith. And this was uncomfortable to watch at certain points. So Anthony Smith's coach had just died unexpectedly last month of a heart attack. And that was like a focus going in here. And man, he is walking down. He's known this coach since he was like 17 years old, like most of his life, and has been there for all of his fights. And he's coming down. He is in tears as he is entering the octagon. Daniel Cormier is just saying right out loud, this guy should not be fighting. They're talking about his coach. Scott Morton was his name. The fight begins, and Smith does seem to get like focused on the fight. But there's an eye poke early to Reyes, so time is called, and Reyes is jabbing away. Smith, at one point, just puts his hands down and is eating the shots as he is put up against the fence. They get to the second round, and Smith shoots for this single, and it doesn't have a whole lot of juice behind it, so he eats all of these elbows, won't let go of this leg, so his head is prone. Smith gets put to the ground, and he's just curling up as Reyes attacks him with elbows. He's underneath on his back. It's total domination by Reyes, and Smith is showing no signs of improving his position. Mark Goddard gave him every opportunity and then some to improve, and he just couldn't. And finally, this one ended at 4:46 of the second round. And afterward, Anthony Smith was asked if this would be his last fight, and he said, probably yes. I've got some thinking to do. And it was just a really tough performance to watch, Eric. Like, I would not be surprised if this is the last we see of Anthony Smith. I feel it's a really sour note that I think, hindsight being what it was, and maybe foresight should have been this too, is just, I understand the mentality that, you know, my coach would have wanted me to take this fight. This guy was in no position to fight, and I just don't think he gave himself the type of opportunity to really see where his skills are. And even in the best of circumstances, like, Anthony Smith is certainly near the end of his career anyway.
Yeah, definitely. This was a tough one to watch. I mean, it wasn't a very competitive fight at that. It was a bit brutal at times. Dominic Reyes was clearly a couple steps ahead of Smith here. He was landing with a lot of power, and you weren't getting an Anthony Smith whose head was completely in the game. I mean, Dominic Reyes, after the fight, said that, like, Anthony Smith was telling him to, like, punch him because he wanted to feel something. He just was not in the mental place to fight here.
It reminded me a lot. This is going back some years, but when Mark Hominick, he fights Jose Aldo at UFC 129 here in Toronto, and he's got, you know, biggest fight of his career. And then that August, his coach Sean Tompkins dies, and Hominick ends up fighting that December. And that was back here in Toronto as well. He goes out and he loses in 7 seconds to the Korean Zombie. And I just remember covering that event. And afterward, they bring Mark, like, usually they bring the winners to talk to the media afterwards. They bring Mark Hominick because he's one of the Canadians on the card. I was like, do we need to talk to Mark Hominick in this state right now? And I felt the same, where it was just so fresh, the loss of this coach that you've been with for so long. And you're just like, that's such a massive adjustment to have to make. And Mark Hominick only fought like two more times, and then he retired. He retired very young. It really brought me back to this. And I thought at the time that this was just way too soon for a Mark Hominick to be fighting. And I felt the exact same way here with Anthony Smith. So I don't know if he steps away and opts to fight again, where maybe things are more resolved, but it was a very uncomfortable fight to watch. Vicente Luque against Temba Garimbo, and Garimbo was replacing Nick Diaz, who was actually attached to this card. I think that
what an absurd sentence that you just uttered. Wow.
Well, I think it would have been a very uncomfortable performance if we had seen Nick Diaz competing on this card. And instead, Grimbo took his place, and Grimbo is attacking with calf kicks, and then he gets dropped with this right hand square on the jaw, and Luque locks in a darce and submits Grimbo in 52 seconds of the first round. And with Luque, I mean, he is... You know, he was soaring for quite some time at welterweight. I think he's kind of petered off, but this was a very strong, a much needed win, I would say, for Luque, who had lost three of his last four coming into this fight and had been coming off a loss to Joaquin Buckley back in March.
Yeah, Vicente Luque is another one who's kind of in a weird spot. I mean, the injuries to his head that he suffered, he's very much in a, it can be a bit uncomfortable for me, at least watching him fight sometimes, knowing that's like,
yeah,
how did this guy even get cleared? But it's like you said, he was on quite a run at one point. A lot of things happened. He's not the same fighter he was, but this was a pretty classic Vicente Luque finish. I mean, a quick darce here. I think what they put the stats on the screen, he has like 14 finishes in the UFC's welterweight division. A remarkably exciting fighter throughout most of his career, which I have to imagine is nearing its end at this point.
Buried on this card, Movsar Ibloev and Aljamain Sterling, everyone, competing here on the prelim, not even the featured prelim. But Ibloev, 18-0 coming into this fight, had fought last in January, beating Arnold Allen. And also, owning a win over Diego Lopez, who is closer to a title fight than Ibloev is. And of course, Aljamain Sterling, former bantamweight champion. To their credit, they were like really low here on the card, but I thought they had a very exciting, like grappling heavy, matchup here, which was really exciting here. Sterling, is landing early on, and then Ibloev gets him up for a big slam and then gets Sterling's back in the first round. Sterling, though, I leaned towards him in this first round. I thought it was very close. It was just some of the striking that made it a difference, but Ibloev did end the round well. Second round, Sterling gets a takedown, and Ibloev takes over control, gets on top of the crucifix, and then would later rock him with a right hand. Sterling goes down. It's Ibloev 3-for-3 on takedowns by this point. And then there was this great use of underhook control by Ibloev as the two just kept up this incredible pace. Third round, Ibloev missed with a spinning back fist, and because of the momentum, gets taken down as Sterling gets his fourth takedown. And Ibloev continues to be placed on his back. Sterling goes against the cage. He's getting shots fired at him, and Ibloev gets the back at the end, controlling Sterling, pretty dominant for the final minute, and landing enough to take it. So I had it 29-28 for Movsar Ibloev, as did the three judges. Did you concur, Eric?
Yep, same scorecard. I thought Aljamain Sterling looked great in that opening round, and he kept the fight competitive as it went along, but Ibloev, he just pulled ahead. He was out-grappling Sterling. He was out-striking him. I thought it was an entertaining fight. You kind of know what you're going to get from both of these guys, and you got exactly what you would have imagined here.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the fight for what it was. There was no fight of the night bonus, so I think that tells you about what the UFC thought of the fight quality. But I guess your question is Ibloev sort of in that John Fitch position where he is just going to have to win so many fights?
Oh yeah. And the second he loses once, he's gone.
Yeah, that kind of feels like the situation he's at, and it does put like a bit of a damper on Aljamain Sterling's featherweight hopes. And just where you can take something is the placement here. I mean, it is kind of indicative of where you see like Aljamain Sterling in terms, both of them in terms of where they are seen, because this easily could have been placed in a higher position where this could have been a title eliminator, especially for Ibloev. And I did not get that sense coming out of this. Brian Battle took on Randy Brown, and it was a battle for Brian to make weight, missing by a cool 4 pounds afterwards. And he was asked about this. It was just pretty much, I'm going to get it figured out. Was it like not,
all right,
it didn't really have any concrete reason for why this occurred. This was not like I missed by half a pound. You missed by 4 pounds, guys.
Things happen.
So in the first round, there was this beautiful hip throw by Randy Brown. Gets a body lock takedown off of the cage and ends the round in side control. Into the second we go, Battle is connecting with the knee to the body and then one to the head. And as Battle eliminated the distance, he worked very well in close quarters here using his knees. And then in the third, it's Brown coming out very fast, gets a takedown, and they go back to the clinch against the fence. Brown separates, landing with a big series of strikes, but Battle ties him up against the cage. I thought like the best flurry was from Randy Brown near like the last couple of minutes here, but you know, it was a very, very close third round that I could see Battle winning, but I had Randy Brown winning 29-28, but the split decision went to Brian Battle, who blamed the weight on the fast turnaround after he fought in September, but did not indicate he would be leaving welterweight.
Yeah, I gave the edge to Battle, but certainly a very close fight. a hell of a post-fight interview. Peak MMA, I think. I have nothing more to say. This was too long ago.
This was a lot of fights, folks. Eric Anders and Chris Weidman. This one went into the second. Weidman, to his credit, he had a good first round here. I thought he won the first round. Anders walked into a left hand and just crumbled here and got cut over the right eye. And then Weidman just got on top in half guard. But in the second, it's Anders that survives a guillotine attempt, and he's on his back mixing in shots, transition to half guard, and then he just starts hammer fisting the hell out of Weidman's face, lands with an elbow, and Anders powers him back to the mat as Mark Smith is giving a lot of leeway to Chris Weidman. That was kind of the theme of the night for these older stars. They were given a lot of leeway, but Eric Anders stops him at 4:51 of the second round, and I just think that Chris Weidman at his age with, what is it, 33 surgeries he's had? I mean, there does come a time where I think just a decision should be made. And when you're losing to Eric Anders on the early prelims, I just think that this is kind of feels like the end of the road for Chris Weidman.
There's definitely still ya boy joke to be made here, but I'll pass. Weidman, yeah, he did have a good first round. I scored for him as well. The second round was very reminiscent of Chris Weidman versus Luke Rockhold, and not in coming into the fight as middleweight champion sort of way. Pretty brutal beatdown for a guy who's taken a lot of damage over the last 10 years.
And then quickly, Joshua Van defeated Cody Durden by unanimous decision. The first round, I thought Durden won the first, but then Van just turned into another fighter in the second and third rounds. His striking was just like, this guy could not miss. He was just delivering to the head and body, wobbling Durden at several instances, and just great use of angles by Van, and then intensified his combinations in the third round, rocked him with a left hook. It was just, I thought, overwhelming in the third round. Like, I thought almost 10-8 territory. Didn't quite go that way. One judge did, though. The scores were 30-26, 30-27, and 29-28. So I would have gone 29-28 for Joshua Van. I did give the first to Durden, but Joshua Van might get a flyweight title fight out of this. Who knows?
It's not out of the realm of possibility.
I say that only half joking.
Yeah, I had the same scorecard as yourself. You know what? I'm not sure I'm ready for that, but I would be ready for Joshua Van versus Asakura coming out of this. I think that would be a really fun fight.
Michael Chiesa defeated Max Griffin. A pretty good performance here from Michael Chiesa on his birthday, no less, turning 37. He submitted him with a rear naked choke at 1:56 of the third round as the family members in the crowd started singing happy birthday. Good performance by Michael Chiesa, especially when he could get this to the ground, and just such a stronger fighter than Griffin on the ground. I mean, Chiesa is exceptionally strong, especially at this weight class. So Chiesa gets a win. He wants to be on the Seattle card in February, and I think for a fight night card, he could be in one of those top fights, sure.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you still see the limitations in Chiesa's striking even this far into his career. He's definitely on the older side now. He's probably doesn't have that many fights left in him. But he's a talented grappler, and you can still do some fun fights with him at welterweight.
Well, he turned 37 on Saturday. Turning 43 today is Clay Guida. And so by that logic, Chiesa's got years left in the tank, or does he? He's taking on Chase Hooper, all right? So Do you remember when Clay Guida and Roger Huerta had their fight of the year in 2007?
I've seen the fight.
You've seen the fight. You might not have been born yet. You are the Chase Hooper of post wrestling, but Chase Hooper was 8 years old when that fight took place. So just for some context there. 2 years ago, Chase Hooper submitted Clay Guida in a grappling match. And it's not hard to see why, because, dude, he schooled Clay Guida. I mean, it was like watching, like, at will, he was able to control Clay Guida. He stops a takedown by Guida with a guillotine threat, hip throw by Hooper. He gets Guida's back and just immediately, just at one point, Guida escapes the back control and immediately Hooper regains it, mounts the back, gets the straight arm bar. I mean, this was just Chase Hooper. I'm sorry. He just ran through Clay Guida. 3:41 of the first round. Afterward, Dana White was asked about the trio of Clay Guida, Chris Weidman, and Anthony Smith. His thought was that all three should retire after tonight.
Man, Luque and Michael Chiesa really dodged bullets by not losing here tonight. They were both this close to being on the go-retire edge from Dana White, so good on them.
What a birthday present from Dana White. And then the opener at 6 p.m. Eastern time, fight one of 14. Kennedy and Zekechu defeated Lucas Dreske at 4:51 of the first round. Nothing like a heavyweight contest ending in the first round. And Zekechu landed with a knee up the middle, cracked him with a right hook, and just piled on in the last minute, and then dropped Dreske with a right hook, finishing him with hammer fists. The big takeaway from Joe Rogan is that Zekechu, who fought at light heavyweight, he now looks like a heavyweight. He looks like a heavyweight. That was our observation in the first round. And Zekechu got a performance of the night bonus. So people were paying attention. Although if you tuned in for this fight at 6 Eastern, I'm not kidding, there might have been 30 people in this 18,000 seat arena. It was one of the least, like the most empty I've ever seen one of these early prelim fights. and a great line from Joe Rogan: other than 125, the shallowest weight class in the sport is heavyweight. You can just put a few wins together and get a title fight. So Joe Rogan, understanding that the pathway at flyweight and heavyweight, not exactly littered with contenders. And he would not be wrong.
No, not at all. Just like to put this in perspective, they were talking about this guy making a title run after this win. He lost to Ovin St. Preux in 2024.
Yeah, let's pump the brakes a little here, okay?
That's what we're talking about here.
That was UFC 310. I think overall an entertaining card, certainly far from card of the year or anything of that substance, but I mean, hey, there was no Kid Rock to be seen on this show. That already puts some points on the board in its favor. What did you think? What were your overall takeaways? Was this a night well spent on 14 fights, Eric?
Yeah, I had a good time at this one. It was definitely too many fights on one card, but they do this all the time.
This was no PFL World Championships.
Man, people don't even know. People will hear us talk about the PFL and the pacing of the PFL because they feel as though they may be familiar with the current status of the PFL. Let me tell you, you're watching PFL shows in 2020. These final shows would go like 9 hours. It killed my love of MMA. That's what we're talking about when we reference these old PFL shows, okay? Nothing will ever compare to them.
Let's end off on this because there were some announcements tonight about upcoming cards to start off 2025. First of all, their last card of the year is next week, a fight night show from Tampa with an interesting main event with Joaquin Buckley taking on new opponent Colby Covington, a rare Colby Covington fight. And then they will have a fight night card January 11th at Eric's favorite stomping grounds, the Apex, kicking off a new year there. And then the next time we will be here is after UFC 311, which they have announced they've announced the whole card, but the main card is highlighted by Islam Makhachev defending the lightweight championship in a rematch with Arman Tsarukyan, which those two fought back in April of 2019 with Makhachev victorious, but a close fight. And Merab Dvalishvili, who if he doesn't have multiple fan interactions over the next month, will be fighting Umar Nurmagomedov in his first bantamweight championship defense. Dvalishvili went after some fan at the show on Saturday night. I mean, this guy is he's nuts. I mean that sincerely. I think this guy is going to end up he is going to get his hands on a fan, and it is not going to be good news for this guy. Like, he is, you want to taunt a fighter? This is not the deal.
Yeah, not the guy.
With,
not
okay?
the guy.
This guy has no spark. Like, he requires no spark for that fuse to go off. But these two title fights look awesome on paper, I think, Eric.
Yeah. I think this is a really good main card. You have Yuri Prochazka and Jamal Hill. You have Benil Dariush and Hinata Moicano. Like, there's a lot of fun stuff on this card.
And then announced on Saturday's card is a UFC 312, February the 9th in Sydney, Australia. The rematch that, man, every month Eric asks me when? Well, the answer is February. Dricus du Plessis, Sean Strickland 2 for the middleweight championship. And Zhang Wei Li defending her strawweight title against Tatiana Suarez, who has been a fighter that, I mean, going back to like when she won Tough all the way back in 2016, we thought would be a future champion. She's had injuries. She's had health issues, serious health issues, but she is finally going to get her title fight and has not fought in since August of 2023. So it kind of tells you, all right, we're just giving you this title fight. Let's just go for it. So interesting to see that she's, I'm not saying like she cannot win this fight, but it's just a unique circumstance here of someone that I think we all saw title aspirations for, but it's just been such a level of inconsistency. Like, she has had three fights since 2019.
I mean, we'll see if this fight ends up happening. I mean,
huge if, I think, is warranted.
Supposed to be on this card, if memory serves correctly.
I think so, yes. With Virni Janjiroba. Yes.
Right. So I don't know. I'd love to see it. She's a very talented fighter. She could totally win that fight. I don't fully expect it to actually materialize.
Well, there you go, everyone. We are now going to put a bow on 2024. Eric, I want to thank you as always for lending your expertise each month here on these UFC post shows. And we will be back in January after UFC 311. If Eric can make it, it's a very lengthy fight card coming up on January 18th. So you have plenty of time to rest up, and no PFL on New Year's Eve to bog you down. I don't know when the PFL is going to, some of these fighters, I don't know if they're even going to get fights.
Hey, on New Year's Eve, anyone who watches PFL is like, what's wrong with you? Ryzen is where it's at on New Year's Eve, okay?
Yes. And for those that were asking the question, would Conor McGregor's name be brought up at the press conference? It was. He was asked for a comment about the civil case where Conor McGregor was found civilly liable, and Dana White's reaction was, what do you mean, what's my reaction? If I had a comment, I would have put it out already. He was then, this is from Yahoo, when pressed in a follow-up question about McGregor's future in the promotion. He hasn't been fighting here in, I don't know how long. Well, if he does fight, it'll be sometime next year. So there you go. That is the status of Conor McGregor. He'll fight. And I'm not going to say anything about this, this case. So that is the Dana White response. On that note, we will say goodbye to all of you. Thank you for tuning in live, and we are going to be back on Monday. Myself and Wei Ting will be live after Raw. And do give Eric Marcotte a follow. He is now on Blue Sky. So that is where to follow Eric Marcotte for all of his musings, not just contained to the world of mixed martial arts. He has many thoughts out there. Are you going to be watching Wrestle Kingdom live in a couple of weeks? Give us a New Japan quick summary.
I'm going to say, yeah, I'm probably going to watch Wrestle Kingdom live. I don't think I'll watch Wrestle Dynasty live. That card doesn't look very good right now. But Wrestle Kingdom, I'll watch it live. I guess, are they going to headline of Naito and Hiromu? I feel like that's probably what will end up going on last.
You don't see the coronation of Shota Umino on January 4th?
I can't see them headlining with that match. I think they'll probably just do Naito and Hiromu.
All right, well, there you go. Follow along with Eric Marcotte, and we'll chat with you after UFC 311 next month. Goodbye.
Fred runs his own landscaping business.
Yeah, with my two brothers.
They take their business very seriously.
Sure do.
Fred traded up to commercial auto insurance from Geico for serious customized coverage that grows as his business does, all for seriously low rates.
All right, so when's it going to happen? You know, the big Geico surprise?
I'm sorry?
Some hair metal band. Are they going to jump out of those bushes?
No. This is a serious Geico ad.
That pyro was pretty cool, though.
Get more with Geico Commercial Insurance. Trade up today at geico.com/commercial.